You're a SaaS founder. You've built something solid, but growth still feels harder than it should. Most SaaS companies don't fail because of bad tech. They fail because they've never become a must-have to the right customer. This podcast is here to change that. I'm Ton Dobbe, and this is the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. Every week, I talk to founders in the trenches, facing friction, making bold moves, and building companies that last. We dig into real choices around focus, positioning, customer pool, team alignment, the things that separate forgettable software from the ones that people can't live without. No hype, no hacks, just honest conversations to help you build something that people would miss if it was gone. If your SaaS should be indispensable but isn't yet, this is your podcast. Let's get into it. The guest of our podcast this week is Martin Balaam, CEO and founder of Pimberly.
I really don't want to lose customers. You know, I know from my life experience how much time and effort, blood, sweat and tears you have in terms of trying to acquire a customer. And we'll openly put our hand up. And I'll be with my, if I'm qualifying with my sales team, I'll say, I can't see whether this is actually going to add the value, even though they might be happy to sign.
This is Martin. We dig into how we built a full-service product information management company, while competitors chase license-only scale. You'll hear how refusing half his potential customers created a moat that competitors cannot cross, and why he spent 18 months finding his US niche instead of rushing to market. The conversation reveals what happens when you optimize for zero churn instead of maximizing growth, and why that discipline becomes your competitive advantage. Well, hi, Martin. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Hello, great to be here. Very excited to understand and have a chat and see where we go.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be a conversation that, it's going to take, I'm not even sure where we're going to take it. When I got in the invitation to have you on the podcast, I checked you out, of course. I've seen a number of things that resonated with me. First of all, that you're a serial entrepreneur, but actually came from accounting, from what I understood.
So a reluctant accountant. So
okay.
Very early days, I did physics, laser physics and holography at Imperial College, and sort of like, you know, really loved that, but wanted to earn money. And then you sort of realize at the end of it, if you want to earn the money, you got to go into the city or finance and things like that. And so the money drew me to the accounting side of it and Deloitte's. And I had a fantastic time. I didn't expect to like it. I thought, oh, I'm going to hate it. I'm going to leave after a year. But actually, because you were going in with a cohort of scientists, at that time, they were recruiting scientists and engineers, not accountants. So like nowadays, you got to have an accountancy degree and everything. Those days, they were like, no, we're going to have interest in sort of scientists and whatever. So we had a great time as a cohort, and I really enjoyed the time I was there. And looking back, really grateful, because it gave me access to, you know, a bunch of entrepreneurs and decision makers that I would never have had access to before. You know, you're there, even if you're just there as a junior doing a bit of photocopying whilst you're in somebody's boardroom or whatever, you don't realize how much rubs off on you, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's interesting how everybody's career goes a certain path and then where you end up. Yeah. So I also saw that you, you've actually been running, Jigsaw 24, the UK's largest Apple and Adobe systems integrator. Grew that from 45 million to 125 million in 5 years' time and exited. But before that, you already started the company that you're running right now, right?
Yes. 2018. I started it whilst at Jigsaw. And actually, as you said, you know, I'd serial entrepreneur or whatever, but basically I'd really found my niche in terms of, I guess what people would know as buy and build, in IT managed services. I think I'd done three of them. Jigsaw 24 was the last one that I did. And I was itching to do something different, you know, And I wanted to do software. I wanted to do a startup. I was thinking, how hard can that be? And so Pimberly was started whilst at Jigsaw 24, and if you like, was incubated there, and ready for my next project, as it were, when we ultimately decided to let Jigsaw 24 go and move on and do something else. So it was that's how that came about, in terms of I just feeling that I didn't want to, even though each project is totally different and you love it and everything, I just wanted a new challenge, and also I got some, you grow up and you get friends and peers and whatever. I got a couple of people that had, that started their own software businesses and whatever, and they would always have a bit of a joke with me and say, "Well, it's all right for you, Martin. You've never had to start a business from scratch." And they're always sort of like, "Well, I want to scratch that itch, and I want to show them that I can do that if I wanted to,
Yeah, exactly. So that's the incubation in the other company in Jigsaw 24. What was the big problem that you saw already 3 years earlier before you actually sold Jigsaw? What was that big problem that you saw that was screaming for a solution?
Well, I mean, I so first of all, the first thing that happened was that I decided that I wanted to do software. I wanted to do a startup. So therefore, with the background that you've got, you're sort of thinking, well, I need to look for, and especially with a bit of the finance background, I need to find a problem that needs solving. I need to find something that's got a hard ROI. And had ROI in our sort of parlance is, you can show that you can accelerate sales, and or you can show that you can reduce costs, therefore increasing margins and cash. And during my time, also completely separately, got a family business that I'm involved in that manufactures bedroom furniture in the UK. And during that period, they were getting asked increasingly for e-commerce ready product data for their downstream sales channels, and just lots of things came together, and I thought, you know what, this could be the problem, and actually researched it more. Also, heard in Jigsaw 24 we'd acquired a small little software business that focused around catalog management for large retailers. And sort of, so you had a little nugget of people that understood an element of it, and that bringing that together sort of like, created the nexus, if you like, of the idea of, right, this is what we're going to do.
Now I get the full picture indeed, because I also saw that family business. Well, back in the days, of course, 2015, there was e-commerce. And I can also, I mean, if I recall back, for what I know about the product information management market, there were also, of course, product information management systems. So what was it then that wasn't solved yet that became sort of the core thing of what you do today?
Well, because of the family business, whatever, a lot of it was all around the digital assets as well, so the images, the videos, the documentation that goes along with being able to enjoy a product, especially if it's a technical product. Being able to install it and service it, etc. So there were, you're quite right, there were, I think at the time, I don't really think PIM was very well known. Everybody used to call it sort of MDM for product data, master management product data, but that truly was just focused around the actual data and governance of databases and who owns what attribute and who has access to it and who can update it, etc. Whereas actually, there were very few, from what I could see, actually coming from the other way, which is, well, where does this data need to get to? The sales data, the things that's going to, the digital representation of the product to the end user, whether that's a B2B or B2C. And you got this sort of, two different worlds. You've got the digital asset management world that had been going on for decades, and then you've got this sort of new e-commerce data, product data world sort of coming out of MDM and finding its feet. And that it was the juxtaposition of the two that I thought, if you can manage any form of data, whether it's structured or unstructured, i.e. images, videos, sound, it doesn't really matter, that's where it's going to go. And also marketplaces would just take it. Of course, Amazon was there and eBay was there. We all know those. But people, big retailers were starting to think about converting themselves to marketplaces, and certainly we saw that in our family business, and so the being able to manage multiple different variants of the same product for each end marketplace was the bit. And you looked at it and I thought, well, there's hardly anything that's doing that at the moment, and it's only going to get worse. As in more complex.
I mean, I can already see that storyline around the complexity exploding, because it's not indeed where you put it once. There's a multitude of channels these days where people are produce the same or put the same product but diff with different ca characteristics. Now I get
Correct.
it.
And then if you layer on it, pre-COVID, everybody was sort of fascinated about hyper-personalization, and that creates more variants as well, because I want to show this product that's specific to you, your age group, your likes and dislikes and whatever. And so that just was a yet another dimension of variance, So, yeah.
Just before we started this call, we talked about the 10 traits of my book, The Remarkable Effect. And I asked you which of the 10 traits specifically resonates with you. And you mentioned aim to be different, not just better. So you've got the business now for 10 years. What did you do did in the beginning already with that in mind, in order to create that differentiation? But more importantly, also something that's defensible and that you keep as a differentiation. What did you do different there?
I basically took what I did as an IT managed service provider, which basically probably annoys probably investors or whatever, but I call it like a full service software provider. So we do everything in-house, as it were. So we'll Obviously, we develop the product, we support the product, we implement the product, everything, integrate the product, everything is done inside Pimberley. We're not, I'm not just selling a license. I'm not saying, oh, here you are, thanks very much. And by the way, here's three companies that are going to that you can choose to implement it for you. And I'll see you later, or type thing. I wanted it. I saw this because, again, it's not a plug and play product. You have to integrate it. You only get any value out of it unless it's integrated with your downstream product data, systems and your upstream systems. So you're not going to be changing this anytime soon once you've put it in. And so you're looking for a sort of a lifelong sort of partner. It's very similar to ERP in its sort of lifestyle. So for me, the difference, and still is the probably the difference to all the other sort of PIM providers out, PIM DAM providers out there, is that we're full service, everything's done in-house, which means that we can't do we can't do so if you look at some of the larger players, there'll be software licenses, they'll be issuing 50, 20 new licenses a month. We can't do that. We can't cope with that because we're doing all the everything. So we have to be very, very, and also for me, I really don't want to lose customers. I know from my life experience how much time and effort, blood, sweat and tears you have in terms of trying to acquire a customer, and so we're very, or try to be very open, and when we go through due diligence with a customer, it's as much to make sure that we can delight them and can deliver them an ROI as it is for them to us. And we'll openly put our hand up, and I'll be with my if I'm qualifying with my sales team, I'll say I can't see whether this is actually going to add the value, and I don't want to. Even though they might be happy to sign, at some point they're going to realize that actually this isn't what they wanted. or it didn't do that. It, sorry, it doesn't. It will do what we want it to do, but that wasn't the problem that they had.
Exactly.
And that's the bit that I think we're different. Is
For
that,
sure.
you know, and I feel com more comfortable, you know, doing that. I'm not a, you know, high growth, high churn sort of thing. You know, I like to think that I've got customers that see us as true sort of long-term partners.
Yeah. You highlight a very core point of what makes successful companies. And it's specifically being ready to say no when you believe that the customer is going to get value, but not the value that is being designed for. So they could technically use the functionality, but they're not going to appreciate it as it was built for. And that you also say, hey, we could possibly take on 10 new customers a month, but we only do five because of quality. I think that is definitely a differentiator because so many companies do it completely the opposite, the other way around, which is actually what I mean in my book with acknowledge that you cannot please everybody. That is such a, it's a mindset more than it is, anything else. And it starts with, being able to articulate, okay, when do we say no? Even if it's going to mean that we have to send a good customer that was willing to pay to a competitor. So kudos for that. How has that mindset and the behavior that you actually put into the company, how has that formed the business?
I think I'd like to think if you asked all my team, you know, what is the number one thing, it is we don't lose customers. You know, we service them, we don't lose customers. You know, if you start off with that mantra and you're saying so, and then you truly understand what does that mean, it first starts with, you know, being open, sincere about what you're good at, and also really caring about what is the problem that they're trying to solve, and being, and again, being pretty open and saying whether we can solve it, and if we can't solve it and we don't feel that we should solve it, then saying it's not for us, you know. So that manifests itself in the sales cycle, you know. So this is not about how many orders can I get this month. You know, it's about what are they, and we have these thing, we call them VIP, sort of. So a lead will come in, we'll work on it, and then it'll go through again, and it'll become a VIP lead, or it won't. And the VIP lead is that we believe that this is we're a great match.
Let me make a small interruption here. Martin just made an excellent remark that sets his approach apart from typical SaaS wisdom. He explained how they qualify customers through what he calls VIP leads, but it's not about order size. It's about whether Pimbly can genuinely solve their problem in a way others cannot. He'd rather send a willing customer to a competitor than take their money and fail to deliver value. His long-term thinking is why they maintain sub 5% churn while competitors chase vanity metrics. And this is what remarkable software companies do. They aim to be different, not just better. Then they focus on the essence. And that creates fans, not just customers. Want to master these traits as well? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
And for us, that's really important. And similarly, on the development side of things, when I first started, obviously you have to build a product in your own mind's eye, because you're starting from nothing and you have no customers. So obviously you talk to people and you talk to potential customers and all that sort of thing. But one of the things that I did straight away, as soon as we could, it was like literally pass over the product development roadmap to our customers. You know, the customers are the number one thing. They are the things that they know what they need. And yeah, okay, you've got to do some triage, and you can't do everything all the time for everybody. But we don't sit there and I mean, I'd love to be like Steve Jobs that could arrogantly say, "I know what you need," but unfortunately, I'm not, and I know that I'm not. But it's a service that we provide. So listening to your customers. giving them what they need is another big sort of cultural trait from a product development point of view. And then the other thing is on the customer care and service, or I guess people call it customer success nowadays. Yes, we have account managers or customer success managers, but we also have what we call technical account managers, and their entire remit is going to talk to the users of the platform, because usually they're the ones whose voice rarely gets heard. And yes, you get you'll have your escalations and whatever, or this needs doing or that needs doing, but it's all the little things that make the big difference, and I found that when I was selling, especially in highly competitive managed service, you could have somebody coming in and selling at the C-level like most people do, to sort of come and replace you or whatever, but the moment that the management go to the users, if the users are saying, "You are joking, we love this company," and so it's a little bit of protectionism as well, because
Tricky.
we're not quite in replacement cycle yet in PIM, because it's still relatively greenfield, but that will come in the years to come, where it'll become more and more replacement. And so understanding and making sure that our customers' users have a voice, and our technical account managers are there to be the voice of our users, and into the development team.
Fantastic. I mean, that connects again to my trait number six, remarkable software companies create fans, not just customers. And the fans typically are at the layer of like the day-to-day use. And they, when things get rough, they defend you if you do the right thing. What I hear is two things. First of all, I like how you talk about, I heard actually three things that you talked to. First of all, about due diligence. If we do due diligence in the sales process, I mean, I haven't heard anybody talking about it in that way, but they actually do it the other way around. It's not that you try to get qualified by a customer is actually you qualify the customer to become a customer of yours, which is a good one. Then you talk about VIP leads, where a lot of organizations, when you hear the thing VIP lead, think that's a big order. It's a very big order. And you think, no, 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 this is very big customer value.
No. Well, I'd say rather than very big, it's more for me. It's more of a dream fit, if you know what I mean.
Exactly, where you
Because,
can deliver the biggest customer value.
totally. We've been in business a long time, so we know that smaller customers grow into big customers. So you've I know that some people say, "Oh, well, what you know? Oh, we want to move up the value chain. We want to move up pyramid and whatever." I'm just as interested in, if I come across a great business that, I mean, I'm quite small. He's quite small and whatever. I'm just as excited, because I know that they're going to grow, and we're going to grow with them, if you know what I mean,
Exactly.
together.
Exactly.
And in 5 years' time, that customer might be, 10x the size for me, and infinitely loyal together, especially if you've been part of their success story.
Yeah, completely agree. Now, you've been around now for 10 years. Let's look a little bit also around scaling. What I saw is that correct? Around you're now around 7 million ARR. So of course during the time you went from 0 to 1 and then from 1 to 3 or 4 and then so you'll go through all these phases. Now, if you talk about, for example, that point where it actually it was required to start scaling, to do things in a more repeatable way, what has been the biggest challenge that you had to overcome then?
Well, don't forget the bit for me was in the early stages, because obviously my previous background, which is the bit where, when I said before, when I had friends that said, "It's all right for you, Martin, but you never had to start a new business." I've always, my raison d'être has always been sort of acquiring at around sort of 20, 30 million. When you've got a customer base, you've got usually got a sales, you've got customer success, you've got all the elements that you need to run a business. And so the early days where you had no customers or very few customers, and also where you didn't have the support mechanisms, you didn't have a customer success, you didn't have an implementation team. Everybody was doing everything, but also you would go, you would, and people know that you could go 3 or 4 months without winning a deal,
Yeah, true.
and you're like, oh my God, whereas obviously when you're much bigger, you're like, well, you would never dream of having a month where you didn't win a new logo. It's sort of like, well, that just doesn't happen anymore, type
No,
thing.
exactly.
So the early days were the days that I found very emotional roller coaster, really. And I'm sure everybody that's done it have been through it. It's like, oh my God, what am I doing wrong? But then, your experience comes, it's like, no, stick to your guns, focus on it, keep going, keep consistent. It will come, and of course it does. It comes, don't chop and change. Desperate people do desperate things. But if you're experienced, you sit back and say, no, we're doing the right things. We just need to soldier on, and it will come, and it does. It comes,
Can you give an example of one of the things that you said, okay, where everybody was sort of doubting it, and you said, we stick to this, and it succeeded?
Yeah, well, so some of the things are, for example, you can't go after it. You look at your target customers that you set, give yourself. You say, right, this is what we're going to be famous for. This, we're good. These are the target customers, whatever. And one of the easy things to do if it gets hard, and you in the early days when you got a, when for example when you've not closed a deal for a few months, it's easy to say, oh, I think we need to widen the customer base, the target audience. I think we need to lower our price. I think we need to give 6 months free trial. I think we need to go this, that, and the other. And you're like, no, these are the positives of that. These are the negatives. Let's stick to our thing. And also, definitely they're the things that you would be faced with in the very early days,
Exactly.
So yeah.
I mean, all the symptoms, widening, lowering price, giving things away for free is only going to attract the worst customer, and it's going
Exactly.
to
Exactly.
pull you
And
down.
as we both know, that if all somebody's having to give up is their time, it's totally different to somebody having to part with even just a bit of cash,
True.
that they've got to then justify to their peers in their business.
Yeah.
It's a big difference, so yeah.
Exactly. So when did you start to go from founder-led sales, because that's of course what the
Yeah.
beginning is all about, to
Yeah.
having a sales force? And what year was that?
Well, I'd say sort of year two, where when you get to the point that you feel that you're really letting the side down by not having enough time to dedicate on the leads that are coming in, the good leads, as it were. That's when you know that you need to bring in somebody. But also, I've my experience has been, if you want to, if you do it too early, then and there's not enough for somebody who's coming in to do, then it can end up in a little bit of a disaster where they'll just come and go, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
Because it's like,
true.
well, I didn't sign up to have nothing to do. I signed up to applying my skills as a salesperson and earning, as it were. And so it is a delicate balance, but I always tend to find that when if I sit back and I think, you know what, I have to say, when I came to the US, it was exactly the same. It was like, that's a bit I quite liked. It was like starting up all over again. And again, it's sort of like when I felt I couldn't cope, that's when I brought on the person, and that I still work that way. I know other companies do it a different way. Their scaling tactics are completely different, which would be, look, you've got an MVP, it works, it's got a USP, you've got a target addressable market, let's basically go big and whatever. And I guess that's just not me, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, true.
So yeah.
You highlighted a couple of well, an important thing here, because you've been pretty much based in the UK in the beginning, in the earlier years, and
Yeah.
then yeah, you now moved to the US. You actually now in the US office, and you said something critical here. It feels like starting all over again because now no one knows you again. There's no
Correct.
customers, no references. People in the
Yeah.
US don't care that you have a UK customer, because they're not like them. So, have you done anything different? Or what are the, if you haven't done anything different while going into the US, what have you zoomed in on that worked extremely well in the UK that you've now, yeah, that has accelerated the momentum?
Yeah, so the first thing is that obviously, you can tell from my trait, a serial entrepreneur, so did the UK, got it up, got it sort of working and whatever, and you're itching then, aren't you? You're itching, right? What's my next challenge? And the obvious next challenge is to open up in another geo. US is obviously the place, but I'll be the first one. I probably it probably took me at least 12 months to work out how to go to market. Because okay, you've got what you do over in the UK, and you think, right, okay, I do all my prep, I identify my target customers. That really drove me to opening up in New York, because that's where, from a data point of view, that's where the maximum density of target customers were, or HQs were. And then but really, it was only till I got here, you then realize, blimey, everybody comes here. I know this is obvious, but blimey, everybody comes here. So in the UK, you'd say, well, how many PIM solutions are there? And really, there's probably half a dozen, decent one. As in, when I say, do you mean decent? I mean, of reasonable scale that customers would typically put on their list. I'm sure there are lots and lots of really good ones that are not quite the scale yet, but when you come to the US, the first thing you realize is, wow, everybody's here. There's lots of PIM solutions that I'd never even heard of before.
True.
And like, you're like, well, yeah. And if you imagine, well, why is the UK is going to be no different to anywhere else? In any country with any mature e-commerce sort of market is going to have its fair share of new PIM, of PIMs. And guess what? They all then ultimately want to get to the US as well. So that was the first thing, was like, right, wow, there's a significant increase in competitive sort of nature. There's a lot more established, larger companies, but that then makes it more exciting, doesn't it? It's like, okay, well, I could either think, you know what, this is really hard, I'm going back, and let's go to Australia. That's going to be easier, type thing, But no, it plays to your strengths, which is, well, actually, if it's harder, that makes it even more exciting.
Exactly.
And then again, because of your experience, you know that, yes, you've got a go-to-market plan and whatever, but you also know that you don't know what you don't know. And it's highly unlikely that it's going to be perfect. And more likely that it's going to be an absolute disaster, as it were. And so it's all about first thing is trying to talk to as many people, get your pitch over, understand what the vocabulary is, how do they articulate the problems in their language, etc. And who are the true competitors that people are talking about? Why is it? What is it they like about them? And trying to find your new niche over here. That's what it took me
Yeah,
18 months probably. And
I can understand.
yeah.
Yeah, I can understand. So it was 18 months before you decided, okay, I open up the office, or were you already there and then it
No,
took
I was
18
already
months to
there.
get.
I think you have to be here to know. You have to be here. You have to be out there talking, listening, losing. You've when you first come over, unless you've got a product that is unique, which I mean, ours is great, but it is, at the end of the day, there's a lot of other products can do similar things, and so you really got to be understanding. And also, you're going to lose, or we find you're going to lose a lot to start with, because you're a nobody, nobody's heard of you. Why should they? This is a mission critical piece of software. So there's just you here. That's very commendable, Martin. But actually, it's too much of a risk for me. So love your product, whatever. Keep in touch. But we're going to go with this or whatever. And then you sort of start eking out your first customer, then your second customer, then your third, and it gets easier. You know, obviously, as you get more referenceability, you get more people that understand you, and then also you start getting inbounds. You know, because people are like, "Well, I'm going to put them on the list. I've heard of them. You know, or heard good things about them. You know, and just organically growing that way."
So what have you done? What have you specifically focused on in order to get that traction? You already mentioned like what you're finding your niche. Have you gone, for example, for one particular industry or so? Because I think I saw that you went for apparel.
So when we first came over, when we looked at our customer base and we looked at those brands that might have resonance in the US, fashion and apparel was the one that we came over with and led on. But as we started to win customers, etc., we then found, interestingly, that because of the original background, which was manufacturing and distribution, some of the complexities of what Pimberley can cope with really were quite well aligned to B2B and sort of like parts and tooling and whatever. And so probably over the last 12 months, you know, we've definitely seen a significant sort of, so if you cut us down now, it would be, well, you know, you've got your fashion apparel, you've also got your B2B now. So, and actually, you know, I didn't know that. And had we have known that before, and we might have led on B2B as soon as we got here, but definitely now it's, you know, and the other thing as well is that, you know, a lot of the B2B brands are, you know, they're not recognized, they're less sexy, and therefore, you know, when it comes to competition in those accounts, unlike a big fashion brand or whatever, everybody's in there type of thing. You know, when these are they've got far more complex things, longer sales cycle, a bit more risk averse, but far more loyal once you're in there and you're delivering what they need.
It comes down again to your definition of the VIP lead, where their context is allowing you, because of how you've architected your product, to deliver far more value than others could with similar functionality.
And you know, so part of the qualifying as well is that how much due diligence are they going to do? You know, if they're not going to actually, because we're quite a technical product, you know, I'd say we implement it ourselves. So actually, my implementation team probably implements more PIMs than any other team in the world now, because you know, I'm pretty confident on that. And if a customer's just sort of like doing a surface diligence in terms of, oh, well, let's just look at features, have a bit of a, you know, like an agile sort of procurement process, you know, we'll have a demo, we'll see if it does this, that, and the other, and then we're going to choose. That's not as exciting to me. Whereas if I've got a customer that's going to say, no, I've got these problems, we're going to go through this, we're going to really drill down and understand it, and I want you to show me how your product solves those problems. And also, I want you to talk me through and show me and give me referenceability in terms of, because this is a, you know, like, oh, it's a proper IT project. And like all IT projects, success is more around the sort of adoption of that platform by the users, as it is the actual what can that platform do. You know, there's plenty of website and great platforms, but if it's not, you know, a great UI or the implementation's not great, the users aren't going to want, they're going to be, you know, and so for me, if somebody says to me, look, we're doing a really sort of thorough due diligence, whatever, great, I'm happy. I know I've got a fighting chance of coming out on top.
Because you understand that they understand it's mission critical, and therefore they take it very serious. Looking at the time, I have a couple of more questions. Sorry. One
All right.
is, in your previous company, you also, what I saw, you also grew through acquisitions.
Yes.
And I'm not sure, I haven't found any signs here that you've done any acquisitions yet. But have you considered doing an acquisition to get entrance to the US instead of doing a greenfield?
You know, at the time I didn't, because I enjoyed the startup bit the first time, wanted to do it the second time. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but to your point, going forward, it's absolutely, my raison d'être is doing buy and build. So, however, Pimbly needs to get to a point that it is, and it's getting there. I'm pretty happy that we're pretty much there, or we will be in the next sort of 12 months, where you have the infrastructure and it is capable of doing a successful acquisition slash and or merger or whatever you want to call it, because I've probably done 30 odd acquisitions,
Exactly.
and enough, most of them have been okay, some of them being disasters, and but then the disasters always is around the cultural fit, and you've got to be ready to, don't the part of the thing I'm acutely aware of is that Pimbly has only ever existed in one office in Manchester until obviously we moved to New York,
Yeah.
and actually suddenly saying, okay, well, we've now acquired another business that's half the size or the same size or even bigger than you. It's a massive sort of psychological thing, and I need, Pibbly needs to be capable and ready and strong enough to be able to live through that, if you know what I mean. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
so it's not yet. I
So,
completely agree. I mean, I've possibly also went through about 20 or 25 of those acquisitions, and it's where it all seems to map on paper. Oh my God. So many things can go wrong there. Let me see. From your entire entrepreneurial journey, moving away from Deloitte, getting into GXR24, starting and building the company that you have right now. What has been the lesson that you've learned very early day that you still benefit from today?
I'd say you have to have different modes of operating,
Okay.
as a leader. So you need to know when you need to be autocratic, and when you can step back from that and just let people get on with things. And autocratic is sort of like when you're going, right at the beginning. When there's difficult decisions to be made in terms of where do we deploy resources, etc., where don't we deploy because we don't have the money just then, or when it's like when do we expand, how do we expand, and things like that. At the end of the day, nobody's going to do that for you, so you have to do that. But then once you've made that decision, you bring your team along with you, and then you get them to buy into it, and then you let them, do what they do best, which is run their departments. So it's going
Exactly.
in and out of those sort of periods of autocracy and sort of running it as a team.
Well said. I agree with that. It's and not many can actually separate the two because they're either this or that. Yeah, but I mean, it's typically those life-changing moments, those big bets for the company that where the CEO needs to step in and have the confidence to say, okay, yes, I'm gonna bet the money on this.
No, I know people say, you get they'll ask you and they'll say, oh, well, it's okay, you've been lucky and whatever. You say, well, no, I think the big difference between whatever word you want to call it, but entrepreneurialism is knowing that everything's a choice, and knowing that, knowing when an opportunity, most people wouldn't see an opportunity or realize actually that's an opportunity, and actually, if you want to, you can make things happen, so
Exactly. So
yeah.
that was exactly the question I wanted to ask. What is the most unconventional decision that you've made that turned out to be a game changer for the company?
Unconventional, I guess, for Pimbly, well, I think it's a little bit early days. I mean, I guess the unconventional bit was just doing it, and just keeping on doing it. It's sort of like, it's I've never had an issue with growing a business. I've always seen it as relatively formulaic. I mean, at the end of the day, when somebody will say, well, What's your path to growing to, let's say, 20 million ARR from your 7 or 8 that you're at now? You say, well, that's relatively straightforward, because my average ARR at the moment is sort of 50,000, so I know that I need to add 20 customers per million type thing, and that's how I always work things out. So I don't know. I don't think there has been. I think coming to the US, I know that a lot of people, at the time said, well, why do that when there's plenty of customers still left in the UK? What is the point? Why would you do that?
Really? Yeah.
But then, there's a little bit of selfishness. I'd already got the UK up and running. I'd got a team that could do that, and it's sort of like, well, I want to take it to the US. I want to take it
Yeah.
out there, and so you got. I guess you got to be a little bit selfish in life, haven't you? So yeah.
Well, yeah, they always say, the moment to say let's change is when you're at the top of your growth, when everything is going well. You have the fat and the energy and maybe also the extra resources in order to do that. But the moment it's already over the top and you're going down, good luck with that.
I mean, you always get, outside observers or whatever that'll have an opinion, and they'll give you the sort of the pat on the back, but then a down sort of thing. Say, oh well, but you're not very big, are you? And especially over in the US, they'll say, well, actually, we'd rather you'd have spent 10 times the money and got half the size, a lot sooner type thing. And in there. If it was all about becoming a gazillion billionaire, that might be it. But that's yes, you want to generate wealth, but ultimately, you want to satisfy your inner sort of desires, don't you, in terms of what you want to achieve and at what pace, if you know what I mean,
Yeah, exactly. What is your definition of success in relation to this then?
I guess it's multifaceted because obviously I've had multiple exits. So I'm it's not like I've not had that buzz of an exit. So I've had a buzz, I've done that a few times. For me, it is being able to say, yeah, I've done it, being proud of what we've built, wherever it ends up, as it were, whether it ends up as an IPO'd larger sort of business, that at some point it will outgrow my capabilities, I'm sure. That's what it's about. Where if you have people that you've worked with now or in the future, they have fond memories of when you were working at Pimble, and that you've got customers, that hopefully in 10 years' time most of those customers are still there and Pimble's still relevant. And then obviously, that it fills your bank up a bit, so that's that. It's not, if you'd have asked me, probably 15 years ago when I first started out on this, it would have been all about, well, it's how much cash I make. And obviously, as you get older and as you get more sort of thing and you have kids and
Yeah.
everything, it becomes more about karma and experience, doesn't it?
I like how you say that. Think it's a good one to end with. Well, coming from that change of how you see success, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share with other tech entrepreneurs, software entrepreneurs that aspire a similar journey?
Yeah, the do would be the biggest barrier is not starting. So if you've got that inclination, and if you're during the day, you're normally doing your day job, but if at night and whatever, you're constantly thinking about what it is, the one thing that you want to start up and do and whatever, make it happen. And if you don't know how start, there's plenty of entrepreneur sort of network events. Just start mingling with people because it'll rub off on you. So that's the do. The don't is listen to naysayers, and whether it's before or after, it's no do. Clearly, there's lots of experienced people out there, and their advice is invaluable. But if you know what good looks like, and you stick to that, and it will happen.
Well said. Thanks for sharing all of this. I mean, there's so many nuggets here. We could talk for 2 hours, 3 hours more, but let's stop it here. Where can people go to find out more about Pimbly or to say hi to you?
You can find me. I've clearly Pimbly. It's Pimbly.com. So Pimberly without the E in the L and the Y. And obviously you can get me on LinkedIn, Martin Ballam. I think I actually think it is LinkedIn/ Martin Ballam, BALAAM. Or if you're on Pimbly, just go on the contact form and just say, because it comes to me as well. That's the other thing. Anybody puts a contact on Pimbly, we've got a bunch of people. I'm in that group as well, and so I'll see it as well. So yeah.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
All right. Thank you. Pleasure.
And this wraps up my conversation with Martin Ballam, CEO and founder of Pimbly. If you got value from this episode, please share it with other SaaS founders who need to hear this as well. And if you got 10 seconds, a quick rating or review on Apple Podcasts will help more people to find these conversations. Thank you for listening to the Remarkable SaaS podcast. If you want more insights like this, subscribe to my daily email, Espresso with Ton. It's a 2-minute shot of clarity for SaaS founders who want to create pull, not push. You can sign up, along with getting my book, at valueinspiration.com. See you in the next episode.